The personal stories of Holocaust survivors are being preserved for future generations, who will not only be able to see a holographic image of an individual speaking, but also ask questions. The high-tech project has been produced by the University of Southern California's Shoah Foundation, which was created by the film director Steven Spielberg. The foundation holds powerful stories from across the ages in their visual history archive, and its executive director, Stephen Smith, is a Holocaust and genocide specialist. He has set up and consulted on many different Holocaust memorial centres and currently holds the UNESCO Chair on Genocide Education. Dr. Smith's experience producing the award-winning virtual reality film The Last Goodbye, which took the viewer inside a Nazi death camp, has been put to good use in his latest endeavour. The collaboration with Heather Myosmith has resulted in Dimensions and Testimony. The interactive artificial intelligence project enables Holocaust survivors to record their memories and respond in real time to questions. So this can happen virtually even after they've died. Ms. Myosmith is the chief executive of Storyfile, which has developed the technology to make leaving your life story this way accessible to everyone. To tell us more about the project, Stephen Smith and Heather Myosmith are with us from California. Welcome. Welcome to 9 to Noon.
Good morning,
Good
Catherine.
Good morning.
It stops one in the tracks in the first instance. And so I think it would be good at the start to explain how this works and what the experience is. People can see a little example of it on our webpage, listeners, rnz.co.nz/9to-noon. But just go ahead, either of you or both of you, to explain what the experience is.
Yeah, Catherine, good morning. It was, you know, this is an experience where we've been collecting testimony for many, many years. And usually when you listen to a life history testimony, what happens is the interviewee starts at the beginning of their life and tells a little about what maybe happened before the Second World War, then what happened during, then how they rebuilt their life afterwards. And it's a linear story and it goes from beginning to end. In this case, what we do, we ask actually hundreds, maybe over 1,000 questions to the individual about each episode and each perspective of that event, as you might have if you were doing a Q&A. And so what we do, we collect all the answers together into a database. And then instead of listening from it from beginning to end, what you do, you ask questions of the database and it returns the answers. So if I ask, where were you born? The Holocaust survivor in this case will say, I was born in this town and this place. And then you could jump to, do you believe in God after your experience? And without having to scroll through it, it will then respond just like in a conversation. Well, actually, because of what I went through, my belief has changed in this way. And so you can move around the entire experience by asking questions much like you would in a conversation.
And so what people are viewing is like a television screen on the wall. Is that correct? But it's very intimate. It's like you are standing in front of this person who's seated and you can ask questions. And I presume there's a lot of sophistication and AI has gone into the recognition of your question and then an appropriate answer.
Yeah, you can actually, the idea was that we would be in a space and you would feel as if that person was in that space with you and you were having that conversation, much less like we've been doing for years on Skype or on FaceTime, things like that. But this is the actual person and you're having this conversation with them. You can do it through a monitor. You can do it holographically in a theater. You can do it on your computer. You can do it on your phone, any mobile device.
So actually in the right conditions, it could be like a 3D experience, a holographic experience, as close as it could be to the person sitting there in front of you.
That's right, Catherine. Actually, what we felt was the most important thing is, first of all, to make sure we ask the right questions and get the right answers. And then we said, OK, so now we're doing that. We'll do that as high fidelity as we can so that we could project that person life size. And then we said, OK, well, we can't bring these 85-year-olds back in 10 years and 20 years. So why don't we collect the information using as many cameras as we possibly can to collect what would be either a holographic or one day a true hologram of that image, so that actually 20 years from now, or even 10 years from now, once we're all using holographic and hologram technology on a day-to-day basis, we have the ability then to project that individual as a full hologram. Right now, you experience it more like full size in high fidelity on a flat screen, Or if you go to a museum, like, for example, one of our partners was the Illinois Holocaust Memorial Museum in Chicago, Illinois. And what they did, they built the first theater that would allow young people to go in, and they sit in this theater, maybe 50, 60 young people, and the holographic image is projected life-size onto the stage, just like they would normally see a Holocaust survivor when they went to a museum, and they would literally have conversation with the hologram in the theater, and it's very, very powerful.
Because of the sensitivity of the subject matter, I imagine some people anyway had doubts right at the start, saying, look, is this appropriate? And particularly if it were not done very well, could it end up being, you know, almost a bit tacky, almost a bit a sense of disrespectful? Could you explain, actually, Heather, I think it was your idea initially, could you explain the journey you went on to convince people, and if there was resistance, where it was from?
Yeah, that was interesting to us, the reactions that we got, because obviously our intention was just to, I wanted to be able to sit in a room, like I said, and have a conversation with the person. I didn't really think that would be odd for people to understand, but and not have vision enough to understand it. But to our surprise, there were a lot of people that didn't have the vision that they could imagine this could be possible. They were afraid that we were, you know, making it into Hollywood, and we were doing all the, you know, the typical production, you know, special effects and things like that. We were getting carried away. But eventually, you know, when we started this, we didn't know if it would actually work. So once we actually made it, and it proved that it was successful and it was impactful and it was building empathy, and people were able to have these conversations just like they would in if the person was in front of them, then people started to come on board, and then everyone was, yes, it works and it's great and da da da. But yeah, it was a long haul.
The survivors themselves, did they have doubts, or were they early enthusiasts?
Well, they were absolutely enthusiastic. It's very interesting because one of the producers of Schindler's List was a gentleman by the name of Branko Lustig. He was also a Holocaust survivor, and he helped Steven Spielberg to found the Show Foundation. And at the time, they said, let's make 50,000 interviews. And Branko said, and OK, I'll be number 50,000, because, you know, he wanted to, you know, delay as long as possible and be the final interview. When we came to do this project, we invited Branko to be one of our advisors. You know, he's a twice Oscar-winning producer and a very respected filmmaker. And so having his advice was wonderful to have. And he said, you know, I said I wanted to be 50,000 last time. I would much rather be number one this time. So it was great to see that. There's a lady actually by the name of Eva Kaur. It was her first anniversary of her death just this week. And it was interesting because when we first announced that we were doing this project, Eva was the first person to call up and say, hey, I'd really like to do that. She had founded a museum in Terre Haute, Indiana.
In the middle of nowhere.
Yes. And she was literally the only Holocaust survivor at that museum. And so she knew that when she passed, her testimony was going to be very important. And so she was one of the first people to do this interview. And it was remarkable to see that on her passing, how every day now young people go into that museum and still talk with Eva. I'm not saying as if she was really there, but they still get a chance to ask her those questions every day.
Is it young people in many ways that you have in mind? Because as we get further and further along in years from these events, and you're getting a further generation back each time, is it the young people you particularly have in mind for this project?
Actually, no, we didn't really have anyone in mind. It's the general public. People go all over the world. You know, these Holocaust survivors go out into the world all over and talk to people of all ages every day. Of course, our love and our passion is about with young people, but it wasn't specifically for them. We do find that it's very effective with them, and they don't think twice about the image or the technology, nothing. It doesn't practically doesn't even wow them. You know, it's just kind of expected.
And it's a very simple form of communication in some ways, isn't it? Standing in front of another human being, in holographic form if need be, and asking a question. What is the potency of that interaction that was the gem of all this? Like, what kinds of things have you seen happen?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, we as human beings, we converse through questions. I wake up in the morning, I say, "Good morning, Heather. How did you sleep? Can I get you coffee? What have you got going on today?" The very beginning of our day is started with questions that we ask each other. And that's how we elicit information. That's how we communicate about very mundane things, but also very profound things. So one of the beauties of this is, you know, a Holocaust survivor has lived, you know, maybe 85 years and has had all sorts of physical experiences, but lots of views about those experiences. And what we found with young people is this. When the Holocaust survivor speaks and tells their story, the students virtually never will ask the question, "Could you just clarify, was it the 13th or 14th of May that you were deported from the ghetto?" What they'll do is they'll ask, what was it like to leave your mother? How do you feel about the Germans? Can you forgive what happened to you?" And what we discovered was, over many years of working in this field, is that young people are really interested in what are the human consequences. And so that's been the most profound thing here, is to see that actually they can be in control of the questions they ask and direct their own learning. What's also really interesting, Catherine, is you don't have to make it age appropriate. We found, for example, in the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York, they put this Dimensions and Testimony exhibition right next to a children's museum. So, of course, these little children were coming along and they were seeing these big screens with life-size human beings, so they wanted to find out. So these 7 or 8-year-olds were walking in and asking questions. Well, they're not going to ask questions about death camps or mass execution or cannibalism or sexual violence. They want to know simple things like, were you hungry? And so actually,
what happened to your friends?
Yes.
They were very concerned about friends.
And so what happens is it's self-regulating, because younger children are going to ask younger questions, and, you know, graduate students are going to ask more complex questions. And so actually we found it a very useful and powerful educational tool.
What we found was,
go ahead.
What I thought was interesting is that we didn't intend this to be, as curiosity driven, I guess. But I mean, we knew that the Q&A is very user led, but coming out of this, we really started using the word user led education so much more. And what we found is that kids really, really resonate with the fact that they can control. Then they have agency over the conversation, and they have agency over what they're learning about. They love it, and it deepens that connection, and it deepens that learning in a way that we never thought would have been possible.
It's a very interesting observation. It's the reverse of how we have traditionally educated, which is a teacher led. I know all the lingo now is student led, but essentially a teacher led series of activities, trying to move towards some modicum of agency and independence in how we learn, but with a whole huge curriculum to get through. This is just pure. This is the person, whomever it is, of whatever age, asking what they want to ask and then leading the whole conversation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Our guests are Stephen Smith and Heather Meyer-Smith. We are talking about this quite remarkable project, Dimensions in Testimony, where in holograph form potentially, or certainly able to be viewed through a monitor, survivors of the Holocaust, including those who have subsequently died since doing their interviews, are appearing and able to be questioned by the observer and to answer. 23 minutes past 10, it is on 9 to noon. And Heather, I want to ask you about how that's possible, because the AI, we're all dealing increasingly with AI doing very basic things for us when we are trying to contact a company. But how sophisticated, how many questions, how much sophistication went into being able to give respectful and appropriate answers to the whatever question comes up? The mind boggles. What was involved in ensuring that you had asked enough questions for the appropriate answer to be drawn by whatever an individual asks?
Yeah, that since this had never been done before, and it was, don't forget, we started this 10 years ago, so we were just somewhat on the cusp of AI and speech recognition, exploding. This was, by the way, this was just after, I think Skype was just coming into its own. So there wasn't even a sense of that you could do this with an AI, or you could talk to a program. But as the years went by, right, as the project, built up the methodology behind it, our intent was always about the content, and it focused really on the content and what kind of content would the public want to engage with and continue to engage with in the future. And a lot of the things, we had a lot of people, you don't know what kind of questions people are going to ask in 20 years, but you actually do know, because human beings have been asking the same questions for over 2,000 years. And there's a very universal aspect that you can come at it with. And that's what we tried to do in the questioning, the line of questioning. We tried to, we don't go into current politics. We don't, go into specific things. The interviewee is prepped to answer certain questions, like by not saying, oh, well, you remember when this happened, or, remember I said this, or things like that. So that it does feel like a natural conversation, because they're answering you specifically based on what you've been asking. They're answering you, and it's a magical event.
Yeah. I would add one thing to this, Catherine. We're very fascinated with avatars and androids and bots and versions of human beings. Mm-hmm. And we'd like to have the idea that AI will somehow replace this intelligence that we already have. We are the most fascinating, wonderful creatures that have, very, very fast reactions and amazing emotions and so forth. So what we said was, let's not try and replace the wonder of the human being. Let's try and see if we can use AI to bring out the best in the wonder of these human beings who've got so much to share. And so our algorithms are really focused on that. And we're not replacing anything. We're just searching through this archive of answers that they've given us and then returning the best answer that we can. And if they can't answer it, they're just really honest and say, I can't answer that, try something else.
It's keyword driven, I imagine. The AI will have learned certain keywords that would reoccur. Hey, listen, I work in radio. You don't need to convince me that keeping it simple. we've been keeping it simple for many thousands of years when it comes to human interaction. But it is something that you would want to be confident of, that you were going to elicit an appropriate answer. But I imagine it is simply just lots and lots and lots of machine learning and keyword recognition. Could we talk some more about those human beings who've participated in this? What are some of their different stories, I guess? We know the commonality of what they went through, but would we be surprised by how different some of these people are? For example, I think one is a 93-year-old US Army veteran who helped liberate a concentration camp, yeah?
That's correct. Alan Moskin liberated a camp called Gunskirchen. And what's wonderful about Alan is, he talks very naturally about the fact that there he was, in the US Army, and a Jewish kid who turns up at a place called Gunskirchen and then finds, the remnants of this Jewish population that had been completely decimated. And yet he's turned his attention in his retirement to really talking about the importance of defeating racism and being open and sharing open societies together. It's wonderful to hear him talk about that. But there's also some others out there, isn't there? For example, the difference between Eva Kaur, who forgave the Nazis, and maybe Anita, who has a different view.
Yeah. What we tried to do is we tried to go into this and said, all right, if you're going to create another archive, or at least a a group of individuals that people could talk to and query about this experience, about the Holocaust and what they went through. You want to have as many different experiences as possible. So we really tried to get people from different, that went through different camps, got into different camps through different avenues, from different countries, were born in different countries, and really had different experiences, whether they were, you know, shipped off as a kid, or they were hidden during the war, or their family escaped, or they were all taken to a ghetto and then subsequently taken to a concentration camp. There are a lot of different stories within this one overarching experience.
Stephen, with your role in particular, you're UNESCO chair on genocide education. There have regrettably been so many events where literally millions of lives have been snuffed out in simply terrible genocide events. And could you speak to what you endeavour to achieve in this work in which you've become such a specialist? Is it simply, if we forget, we'll do it again? Is it trying to develop an empathy and an ability to confront and grasp something that to many of us we just want to turn away from? How do you come to your work?
Yeah, you know, in fact, the Shoah Foundation's mission is not to archive testimonies of the past and keep them in a, you know, big database in California. Our mission is to develop empathy, understanding, and respect through testimony. And what we're really saying is that, you know, this archive is as much as it tells us about history, is really an archive about human existence, about the choices we make, about the learning about others and what they went through. We have 10 genocides in the Shoah Foundation's archive right now, including up until the Rohingya, you know, a couple of years ago, that left Myanmar escaping for their lives there. And so, you know, this is covered now from Armenia from the early part of the 20th century, right up in 100 years to the early part of the 21st century. And what we're saying is we can't compare human suffering, but if we can listen to those voices and we can give access to these testimonies to our young people, and that they can learn from that about the values of human existence, and they can learn to respect each other, then they might be the voice of conscience we need in the future to prevent it. So there's no big mantras here. It's just let's learn and let's listen to one another, because that seems to be the key for this.
What is it that motivated you to work and specialise in this area?
Well, I came from the UK. I grew up in a Christian family in Nottinghamshire, England. And in fact, my family went on a family vacation to Israel to go and see the Holy Land as a Christian family. And when I was there in my teens, I realised that, you know, I was looking at the Western Wall, you know, where the temple used to be in Jerusalem. And I realized, wait a minute, the founder of Christianity came here as a Jewish person, and I have no idea what I'm looking at and why not. So I thought I was interested in Judaism and Jewish history. And then as I began to look at it, I saw this long history of anti-Semitism, which has gone on and on and on. And I said, you know what, we've got to do something about that. And of course, that brought me then to the fact that the end point, or I hope not the midpoint, but the end point of much of that anti-Semitism was the Holocaust, where Jews were victims of genocide because of that hatred that had gone on for centuries. And so I founded the UK Holocaust Center with my brother, and then a genocide prevention agency called the Aegis Trust. And in the process, it was the Holocaust survivors, actually, who were my greatest mentors, who taught me about this very dark period of history, but also how to come out of it and how to build a world that's free of hatred. And I am tremendously grateful to all that they have taught me.
Heather, were some very confronted, though, in the preparation of this? I mean, they're remarkable. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Edith Eger, who's one of my favourite interview subjects ever.
We're both from San Diego.
A phenomenal psychologist now, actually, who's helped so many people live with and walk with the trauma that you just can't ever get rid of, but learn to live with it and walk with it. But for some, I still remember saying, now if she sees barbed wire, she's straight back there. For some, was the act of participating in this, however much they may have wanted to do it, did you see some things that were painful to see?
Oh, of course, yeah. I think that what was interesting about this process is because we're asking so many questions and we go into so many layers of the, you know, of a specific conversation, we asked questions that they are not regularly asked. And that was, I think that actually they were more surprised at how they reacted and the things that happened. We were very cautious about making sure that they weren't re-traumatized during the process and that they were okay throughout it. But it was very interesting. Yeah, the whole interview process was fascinating.
Are there further plans then to do more? What happens from here?
Well, also the Shoah Foundation's project Dimensions and Testimony is ongoing. They're working in different languages. They're doing more with 360 and VR experiences, and you know, combining the Dimensions and Testimony interviews to those with those technologies, which is exciting. And for myself, I have started a company called Storyfile, and it was interesting because as I was going around the country and the world, you know, testing these Holocaust survivors in the public and gathering data for the conversations, invariably the questions I got were, oh, can I do this for myself? Or how do I do this? And can anyone do this? And can I do this with my mother, my aunt? Can I do this with the founder of my company? So we began to think about what it would look like to make this technology ubiquitous for everyone to be able to record their story, preserve their legacy in this way, so that generations from now, people could have conversations with anyone they wanted. I mean, think about it. If you probably have children, and those children will in 50 years have great grandchildren or 60 years, and they, if you do a story file today, they will be able to get to know you, having never met you. So that's kind of the big vision in 2 minutes.
Thanks, both of you, Stephen Smith and Heather Myo-Smith. And you can see more of the project. You can actually see an example of what we've been discussing if you go to our webpage, rnz.co.nz/9toNoon, and click on the video there.